Well, welcome everybody to the latest episode of the Palisades Podcast. I'm Steve Crone, and we are here with a special guest, a friend of mine, Jessica Rogers, somebody who probably 6 months ago most of you might not have heard of, and in the last 6 months, like a rocket, she's just exploded. She's been all over the news in the Palisades on some of the big issues, and we're just delighted to have you with us today, Jessica. So welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Miriam, what do you think?
I'm thrilled that we have Jessica here with us today. We sort of reached out to her last minute, and we're hoping she'd be able to make it, and she did. And I'm thrilled to talk to her because, A, she's had an incredibly interesting life. B, she's a bona fide Palisadian. And C, she's kind of in the middle of a big issue right now, and that is homelessness. And I think she's had a really steep learning curve, but she knows her stuff at this moment. And I think it's going to be a great conversation about, you know, general life, you know, how you twist around the world and end up in the Palisades. And then, you know, we can touch on homelessness and some of that stuff.
Absolutely. And full disclosure, Jessica is the president of the Palisades Residents Association. I'm on the board of that association. So, but we're still going to be really tough on her.
We always are. We always are.
Anyway, as Miriam knows, I always like to kind of find out about someone's background. So let's take a few minutes and go back to where you started and how you got here. And then we'll segue into how you came onto the scene in the Palisades and the issues that you've been focusing on since you become president of the PPRA. So I know you were born in Chicago and then raised somewhere else. Will you tell us a little bit about it?
So both of my parents are from the Midwest, and I was about 4.5 years old when we moved to the south of France. Before that, we actually had a short stint in London. My parents went to the south of France, fell in love, and my mom still lives there.
They just went there. There was no business, no family, nothing. They just loved the place and decided to stay.
A nun had once told my mother about Cap Ferrat, and she had no idea where it was. And when she was having lunch at the Chateau d'Aix and pointed down to the near island and said, "What is this?" And the waiter said, "That's Cap Ferrat." She said to my father, "We must go there. I need to live there." That's the story.
How long ago was that? Like what year?
That was in the early 80s.
And your dad just said, "Okay, I'm good with that," or?
Yeah, that's one very generous and loving thing that he did do. He's done lots of loving, generous things.
I was going to say, is that it?
But that was a really big one.
And did anybody in your family speak French at the time?
No, but I did. My very first word was cochon.
Which means?
Pig.
Oh.
A little boy who was there at the house when I first got there taught me that word within the first 5 seconds of me stepping out of the car.
And your parents just learned French as time went on? I could see where a kid would learn it with people, you know, friends in school and playing in the neighborhood.
Yeah. My mom speaks a beautiful broken French after many decades.
And so you were raised there from the age of 4.5 until?
Until I graduated high school. And they said, "You need to go learn about your country."
And during that time, did you come back to the United States to see other family or friends? Or were you pretty much in France all the time?
We were mostly isolated. We did do a few trips to Springfield, Illinois to go visit Grandpa. But for the most part, we made our life in France.
And what was it like for you growing up there?
I think it was like what it's like for all Europeans. It's very active and culturally rich, exciting. The quality of life there is really fabulous for everybody. So it was a lot of fun. It was great. Loved it. Loved every second of it.
Wow. I've heard of people going to live in other countries, but rarely it's off on an island by itself like that.
It's kind of funny that the first word you learned was cochon. How long did it take for that same kid to teach you je t'aime?
I won't say what the other word he taught me.
Oh, no.
But, you know, clearly he must have liked me.
Yes.
Because he came up with all the naughty words to teach me first.
So what grade were you in? You were like a little girl.
So let me think. I started first grade in France.
And you were there straight through high school,
All the way through the French baccalaureate.
Oh, wow. And your French right now must still be great.
Yes, I mean it's
Yeah.
okay.
And do you go back? Well, you have kids, so do they have like a global sense because of your sort of awareness that there is another continent, over yonder that's kind of interesting and rich, as you say, with a totally different vibe?
We speak a lot of Spanish at home. I chose Spanish because we live in Los Angeles, and I speak fluent Spanish, so my kids speak it reluctantly often, but they speak it. They know that mom's fluent in French, and they have traveled to France, and we take them places. But it's different. They're growing up with an American upbringing, not a European upbringing.
Yeah, but they're aware of the world, obviously because of your background. I think that's kind of cool.
Was there anything about looking back on your someone would look at and say, "Oh, that's where she got the bug to get into social activism." Is there anything like in high school did you run for office? Were you active volunteering? Anything that would lead from there to where you are now?
To be fair, no. If you saw how I was at home, I have many siblings and I sort of always ran the household. You would see it there. The other place where you'd see it is with my mother. My mother has been of service her entire life, and she's always been of service to the community. Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat only has 4,000 people living there, and she was always helping somebody, and she belonged to most of the associations. So whether it was for the safety of the environment or protecting, she just was very involved, and I wasn't aware, but I guess I was paying attention.
And then I know that you went to McGill University,
Correct.
and which is in Quebec,
Montreal, yes.
and did you go there because it was French speaking?
No, I went there because my parents told me I needed to learn about my country, so they shipped me to America, and I was a very sophisticated 18-year-old who got to America and did not relate to the 18-year-old teenagers in Winter Park, Florida, at Rollins College. So the agreement I made with my parents is like, listen, you'll get me out of Europe, but let me go to Canada because I needed an international city. And so I applied and got into McGill University, and it was a much better fit for me. Most of the students there were international. They were well traveled. They just had a very different view on life than most 18-year-olds, especially the ones that were in Winter Park, Florida. And not to diss on Rollins, it was a fabulous school. It just wasn't the challenge I was looking for.
Huh. And what were you studying at the time? Like, what did you think was going to be the future?
What did I think was going to be the future for my life? Oh, I had absolutely no idea. But I'm a very curious person. And so I studied a lot of different languages and I majored in political science.
Oh, wow.
Ah, there's
Totally
the
makes
first hint.
sense. Yes.
There is the activism.
Absolutely.
Just in its nascent term.
Absolutely. And then at McGill?
Oh, well, so no, in liberal arts, so it was at Rollins, it was mostly liberal arts. I was in and out of there in a year and a half. I did a season abroad in Madrid, and then I went to McGill, and it was in McGill that I did poli sci, and it was just 2 full years of poli sci. And what's funny is there I decided I would never get into politics.
So I know that after McGill, you went to that other school across town.
USC.
You could say it. I can't say those words, those letters. And was that straight from McGill onto USC?
No, I had a full decade in the corporate world.
How did that come about?
It's sort of a long story. I was asked to take over a business in Atlanta, Georgia, and to help them make a move out to Los Angeles. And in addition to having my mother's skills and wanting to be of service, apparently I have my father's drive. So my father...
I believe that. I've seen evidence of that.
So my dad's a little bit of a workaholic and an overachiever, and he just likes to make things happen. And so I was given an opportunity to sort of jump in, and I did. And it was in manufacturing, and I just went out there and I loved it. I thrived on solving problems, fixing things, getting teams to activate and turning around a business and turning a business from a dying business to a thriving business. And so there I was in my very early 20s succeeding, and I was given the reins to do so because I was so successful at it.
And yet after a decade or so, you switched directions and go ahead.
So I kept getting bored. I noticed that it was fun to fix things and it was fun to see that I could do, that I could change things, that I could get into a new setting and switch things up. And then I'd get bored because it would sort of, there would be a status quo and everything would be fine. There'd be nothing left to fix. And I started searching. I was in my late 20s, and I realized this isn't what's the me- I was at the point of what's the meaning of life. And I knew for me it was never about accolades or money, titles. None of those things excited me. And so I actually, back when they had bookstores, I bought a book, and it was like one of those like, you know, something for dummies kind of book. And it was a book on like how to volunteer. Wow. And I flipped through this book and I started volunteering. This was back when you weren't really using the internet much for those things. And all of a sudden my heart exploded. I found my happy place. I started volunteering with School on Wheels in LA. I volunteered. I did all kinds of different volunteering escapades. And it turns out that I really liked working with School on Wheels, with kids who were in desperate need in foster care situations or in shelters. And I really, really enjoyed working with the elderly. And I was volunteering at Westwood Horizons at the time. That's what it was called, on Tiverton and Westwood.
Is that at Tiverton and Weyburn?
Yes.
When I was in college my last year at UCLA, I was a floor advisor in that building. It was called Weyburn Hall, and I supervised a group of 80 freshmen in that same building, and then became a senior citizens place. So I know it well.
So I met a woman there who changed my life. Her name was May Iyer, and we had the most beautiful, loving experience together for 10 months. And I realized when she died that I wanted to whatever I experienced with her, I wanted to be able to experience again. And slowly but surely, that was the move from the corporate world to go back to school, get two master's degrees. And I was lucky enough that for 10 years I did. I lived the loving experience I had with that woman. I got to experience with hundreds of other seniors in our community in the Pacific Palisades.
I know we first encountered one another on the phone about 15, 20 years ago, I don't know, when I had a case as a lawyer, and Jessica's working as a social worker at Kehillat Israel, and I put a client in touch with her to try and find this woman something to do for the community as an alternative to going to jail.
Mm.
And we pieced that together years later. But so you... Were you at Kehillat Israel for all that time, or were you working other
places?
I was at
KI for the whole decade. I was also, you know, I had two babies while I was there. But, yeah, I was at KI for a whole decade.
So your two degrees, your two masters from USC were in what?
Gerontology and social work.
Okay, so that's the connection. And so for 10 years, you were at KI sort of helping older people find meaning in volunteering?
I did everything from create all kinds of programming for seniors to special events, to spending a lot of to one-on-one therapy. And I did a lot of mediation for families, crisis mediation, mm-hmm. whether it was the parents who were upset with their children. We're talking mm-hmm. adult children. Right. Or it was the adult children who were worried, concerned about the mm-hmm. adult parents. And just a lot of case management work. Oh. And in that process, because I was the social worker for the synagogue, mm-hmm. I helped many families who had all kinds of crises. That if they came through KI and they needed something and the clergy realized this is above and beyond what mm-hmm. we can really do as clergy, what they loved having me there mm-hmm. is because they knew.
You would find solutions.
Well, I would find solutions, but I also had the proper boundaries mm-hmm. and the experience to provide real solutions.
Yeah.
So we made a great team. We didn't advertise me on purpose because otherwise there wouldn't have been enough hours yeah. to help everybody. But we helped a lot of people. It was some of the best times of my life.
Sounds like an amazing role. Really sounds like a role that was so, I mean, inspirational for you, but also had to have come from a place of genuine empathy and you know, a place of not just empathy, but your ability to sort of see people's situations and look for solutions and figure out who or what or how you would get them through that moment. That's amazing. Was that your intro to the Palisades, KI?
No, I had while I was in school, we moved to the Palisades. It was a compromise. I wanted to live in Malibu, and my husband at the time, it was a city guy and thought that Malibu was just way too out there. Yeah. And so I said, there's a place called the Pacific Palisades, and I think it's a perfect compromise. And it ended up being an amazing place to be. It still is. We love it here. My kids are so happy to be in the Palisades. We've met amazing people in this community.
Why did you stop working at KI?
The real truth is that I would never quit because I could just never say no. So there was that. But the truth is they had some downsizing. You know, they ran into some tough times and they had to make some cuts. And my position was always a bonus. Mm. It was definitely not necessary. And so I was part of some big cuts that they had to make a few years ago.
So how long did you live? I think you told me you lived in the Palisades for 14 years now?
Something like that,
okay.
Yeah.
And how long did you live here before you got involved with PPRA?
So I've been involved with PPRA for over 8 years.
Oh. And
what drew you to that?
How did I get involved with
PPRA? Yeah, what caused you to get involved?
So I live above the high school. Mm-hmm. And 8 years ago, we went from a marching band of like 18 kids who would just sort of pop, 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 you know, for a few hours in the summer, and then you would never really hear them, and that was the end of it, to an amazing instructor who just devoted her life and her time to building up an 80 to, I think it even grew up to 100 or so member band, marching band. And it became a marching band that wasn't just a small group of kids sort of messing around. It became like college level, amazing marching band. And she had techniques where she liked to use amplifiers that faced into people's homes. So my house would shake.
Oh my God.
My little 1950s house would shake every single night, the entire fall season. After my husband at the time just was exasperated and he knew that legally it was wrong, he brought in sound engineers, everything. He's like, this is like, it's literally torture. It was torture for the whole neighborhood. It was terrible. We were excited for the kids, but we were like, nobody can live like this. I heard about PPRA, and I went and met with PPRA, and even though we never actually addressed that issue through PPRA, I don't know, something happened. I think my mother's calling, I met this amazing group of people, and I heard what they had to say, and I realized I'm part of this community. It's time that I do more than just what I was doing at KI. I want to give back to my community in another way. And so I joined PPRA.
Who was the chair at the time? 8 years ago.
Sarah came on like literally around within then. The same month as I came on board.
Sarah Connor,
yes.
Who just stepped down at the end of last year, right?
Yes. Well, we sort of transitioned the beginning of this year, yes.
So how did it come about that you took over as president? Did Sarah just call you up one day and say, hey, I'm leaving? I want you?
She'd been telling me that for quite a while.
Right.
And had she not like dropped the just said, this is it, your time is up, I would still not be president. So, no, I mean, she got approval from other members on the board. She definitely, it was discussed, and it was something that's been in the plans for a long time. I was just the last one to really want to have anything to do with that.
So I love it because Sarah was brought on by Barbara, right? Barbara Cohn, who launched PPRA a good like 25 years ago, who, not dissimilar to you, is this powerhouse of a woman who's guided by, guided by something that behooves most people, right? I mean, she has a sense of what's right, and she, you know, chases that. I mean, she's a little bit older now, so she chases a little slower. She's actually on the Democratic board.
Don't we all?
But yeah, just, you know, another woman who was like, this is, you know, I've got to do something for the world that I live in. It's not just enough to be here. I'm going to be proactive about my community, about preserving it, about, you know, making it great for everyone. And she was really quite a powerhouse for years and years.
She still is.
She's still. Yeah, I mean, I sit on a couple of boards with her, not taking away her powerhouse status. But yeah, she found Sarah and brought Sarah on board. And then Sarah found you again, you know, someone who clearly is inspired from a place, you know, down deep.
What was it that made you say, OK?
Well, let me just say,
I mean, here you were just you were a mom, and mm-hmm. you were not employed at the time. And what made you decide to, OK, jump into this situation?
I have such tremendous respect for what PPRA stands for, and I have such tremendous respect for the amount of love and work that people like Barbara and Sarah have put into this organization over the years. And I have so much respect for all of the ancestors of who have created this community, who have stood up for our community, who day in and day out are paying close attention to all the details of what makes the Palisades so special, that when Sarah said, listen, you need to do this, there's just no other option for me other than to say, okay, all right, I'll do this. And I do it with a lot of humility, because I really understand the amazing privilege it is to be able to represent our community in this way. I'm very humbled by it.
You've been the president for how long?
Let's say the official date was, I think, early March.
So like a year and a little.
No.
We're talking this year.
So yeah, like 3 months. And in those 3 months, what was it within 3 days of when you became president, the whole bombshell about the homeless encampments at Will Rogers State Beach was dropped in your lap, right?
I had all these amazing fantasies about doing community work where we were going to unite everybody and sort of bring out the PPRA. I really wanted to do work with the new association, the Resilient Palisades. I had all these great, like, I wanted to work with a historical society, create these great events because next year is a big anniversary for the Palisades.
The Democratic Club of the Palisades.
Yes, of course, work with the Democratic Club of the Palisades. And instead, I've been working 17-hour days to protect our very vital environment with this motion that our council member came up with to put people at beaches and parks in our district.
Had you met Bonin before?
I met him once at the farmer's market. Mm. Mm-hmm. I've never met him in person. but I've certainly been addressing him a lot lately.
Yeah, but like before this came along, you kind of had a sense for his retail politician like style.
Yes.
Okay. And then this came along, and what was it like? Was it like PPRA by instinct was like, this isn't going to work, or did you sort of watch community reaction?
Oh, no, it was immediate.
Really?
It was like I woke up, okay, we're on.
Hmm.
We're on because, so you now know I'm a social worker, and in the years that I did social work at KI, I helped homeless people in our own community often. Hmm. I was very envious that I couldn't belong to the task force because I had young kids and my ex wasn't going to let me go out and walk the fields. But I really, that's something that I really wished I could have done because I have training in that area and I have an understanding of suffering and what it's, and mental illness and substance abuse and being at the bottom of the bottom and not knowing how to find real answers. So when this came up that we were going to, that it's being suggested that a location be put down at our beach to help the homeless who are the ones who are living on the streets and who are, for the overwhelming majority, struggling with mental illness and substance abuse, I realized how catastrophic this suggestion is. And so for me, everything that I've done so far in my life just all came together at once and says, you have to use every single tool you have right now to raise awareness, educate people, and stand strong on something that is wrong on all levels, and be the voice of reason, and hold the space so that the proper solutions can emerge from this.
I mean, what about the idea that you would bring some limited number of homeless people, put them in a place where you could sort of know that they're there, count them, understand who they are, and bring services to them?
When you put it that way, right, it sounds simple and easy, but it's not. The problem is we have laws that are not being enforced right now. So if you have lawlessness, nothing will work. And the biggest concern in terms of safety for any community is to be aware of what your threats are. What are my risks? What are the actual threats? And what comes with this package? So it's one thing, because the way you put it, it just sounds like, oh, well, you have people who are hurting and who need help, and we're going to bring them together, and we're going to give them support, and we're going to give them help, and everything will get better because of that. That is a, like, oversimplistic, you know, way of looking. It sounds nice, and it would be like if you said that about your children, right? You know, if I'm going to give my two-year-old some sugar because it's sweet and they like the flavor of it, and then they'll be happy because they had some sugar. Well, we all know what happens when you give a two-year-old a lot of sugar, like chaos ensues. This might not be the best example, but it's similar in the sense of we don't have proper laws right now that protect us and give us what it is that we need for a safe environment for the people experiencing homelessness that we're trying to help, and wherever it is that's being suggested they be placed, where that it's not going to affect the environment around them. So we're looking at the most popular, wildly accessed beach of all of Los Angeles, and we're looking at creating an environment to assist people in getting out of whatever substance abuse issue they have, trauma they might have, and mental illness that they might have, and that maybe medication could assist, therapy could potentially assist. We don't know, because these are people who've been living on the streets for a very long time. Their histories are complicated. Their traumas are complicated. So what we're looking at is, and the concern right now in the city of Los Angeles is the number of homeless keeps growing and growing. And now, because we haven't instituted the laws that already exist, we've literally just swiped them aside and said, we're not going to deal with that. Some of it had to do with the Boise case. Some of it had to do with our pandemic. Some of it has to do with the way our councilmen have decided how they want to operate and do things. And it's created, clearly, it's created a mess. And I was actually at the city council meeting this morning where they were discussing LASA, and they were discussing how this one entity has caused so many stoppages and so many issues overall. Instead of actually helping, it has caused more trouble. One of the councilmen was saying, we can't help a homeless person unless they have a social security card. Well, and I know because I actually had to do this in the last year, if you want to get your social security card, you have to mail in your driver's license and some other form of ID. So you can imagine all these steps that they have to go through, all these hoops, and then they still can't get housed because you have two caseworkers. I think he said two caseworkers for tens of thousands of beds being available. I mean, so there's so much involved in this. And the most important key here, I believe, is that when we have councilman who decides to, you know, who realizes, well, I've done nothing, I have to do something, and insists on creating a new policy or building a shelter here or there without involving the community as a whole, here is where we have real danger. Because you can say the immediate argument is you're either a right-wing person or you're somebody who just doesn't really want to help because, you know, you're afraid of the unhoused or whatever that is. That's so far from the truth. What we're needing to understand here and what the Pacific Palisades Task Force on Homelessness clearly understands is we have a need for compassion. We need to raise awareness in the city around what does it mean to care for all human beings in our communities? What does it mean to be so concerned for the life of somebody who's living on the streets, regardless of what choices they made, regardless of what got them there, that we're going to look at this as a whole, and we're going to say, okay, we're looking this as a whole, and how can we do what's best for everybody involved? And now when you involve beaches and parks in a city like the city of Los Angeles, who has such a large number of minorities who live in neighborhoods that don't look anything like the Pacific Palisades, where they're living in tight, confined spaces, where their neighborhoods are unsafe, where they don't know if by stepping outside they might get shot or something bad will happen to them. Their need for our beaches and parks on this side of town is so critical that when I talk about compassion and when I talk about looking at the quality of life for all members of this community, that's who I'm talking about. We have a rich city with members from everywhere who need access to our beaches and parks. They need a safe place. Now, in the Palisades, some people might have big, nice backyards where they're safe at. Most places in the city, they don't have that. They need our beaches and parks to come to be safe, to congregate with their families, to have their events. And we need, and so for them, and our homeless also need to be, if you really, truly want to help somebody, it's about the relationship. We keep talking about it. Right now you have a whole debate in Venice about who's doing what in Venice and is the sheriff doing it or is some other group doing it. But what you hear is that they're on the boardwalk speaking to the unhoused one by one. It's a relationship that gets built. It's the relationship that makes the change. And I have to quote my friend Jess Echeverry from SOFISA. She is the executive director of SOFISA. And she kept telling me, because I was asking her these questions, I was like, Jess, I just help me here. And she said, She's been she's had this homeless services business for decades now. And she said, as long as we keep looking at the issue of homelessness as a transactional issue, we're never going to get anywhere. And she said, you know well that it's not transactional. It's relationship. So if we keep looking for solutions in helping with the homeless crisis as a transactional solution, we're going to build 50 of this. We're going to put 100 here. We're going to do this room key thing here. We've got it all wrong. What we really need to be looking at is the human beings involved and how they get affected. And so one thing is by putting them in environments that have nothing to do with where you would normally be, like a beach or a parking lot, you're already creating an environment that's not a healing environment. I understand we need temporary housing. We need to create temporary housing that's actually temporary housing. That's not a shed or a shack or a tent at the beach. That's not, you know, surrounded with wired fence so that people could stare in at you and watch your, you know, your defeat, watch your lack of dignity. That is not compassionate. I can go on forever. So.
No, that was, I know, that was all great. And clearly you have a sense of homelessness. I mean, you may not have worked in it forever, but you clearly have a sense of homelessness. You know, I mean, obviously I was the founding chair of the task force. And the one thing I learned was that it's not homelessness. It's not all people are exactly the same. And as you say, there are more people, increasing numbers of homelessness in LA because more people become homeless than we can take out of homelessness. So maybe we should sort of focus some of our resources in the beginning part where people are just becoming homeless. Their issues are, as you say, easier to solve. It's not as transactional. It's more learning who they are, how it is that they're vulnerable to homelessness, what can we do to prevent that? And then maybe on the other end, you know, we'll end up seeing fewer chronically homeless people. But my question for you is, knowing everything that you know and really the I don't want to say passionate, but the very human way that you're viewing this behemoth of a problem. Let's say that Mike Bonin's proposal does not really gain traction enough to be implemented, which I happen to think will be the case. Who knows? But I don't think it's going to get to a point where it can realistically be implemented, at least in this immediate environment. Do you guys at PPRA like say, okay, so let's assume that we can, you know, with the help of the rest of the community, defeat this. But what next? Like, how can we help homelessness?
I mean, that would be something at the time that PPR, the board, we would have to discuss. Mm-hmm. But with everything that we've been through, mm-hmm. I think this is something that will be with us just the same way the task force on homelessness was created. It was created when we all of a sudden had a crisis. So now we have a crisis. I have a strong sense that we will be involved with the rest of the community, whether it's just our district or all of Los Angeles or something much larger than that, that needs to be addressed, that we need to start looking at it differently.
Yeah.
So that, like you said, so that there's preventative measures in place, that we're looking at what it means to have people in society who just aren't going to make it. And I'm actually really excited about it because I believe this is a time for big change. Mm-hmm. And people are motivated because we are compassionate.
Yeah.
Let me take her question and change it a little bit. Not so much asking what you think PPRA might do. If you were Mike Bonin, what would you do?
Right now?
Mm-hmm. And if you know, he gets recalled, you get swept into office based upon your immense popularity during this last period, and you are in his position. What would you do personally to address the homelessness problem?
I would work with the city. I would work with all the councilmen. I would request that there is an across-the-board agreement on how things are done so that they're working as a team rather than, you know, all separately. Each district has a responsibility of this and that. That's nonsense. Locations are throughout the city are very hard to come by. he has, poor guy, he's got a district that's really tough to find locations and places. I'll give him that. So that's one thing I would do that. But I would work, I would actually be requesting national reform. We need some major changes in terms of the way we look at mental health right now. And I would be advocating, I would be, just the way I'm handling PPRA, I would be doing it, you know, in that seat with whatever power I had to raise awareness and say what we're doing isn't working. It hasn't worked for decades. This needs to change.
So I understand, and you know my position. I agree with you that this is not the way to go, the homeless encampment at the beach. But I understand that the neighborhood councils on the west side are united against it. What about the neighborhood councils in the other parts of Los Angeles? Are you in touch with them? Do you know how they feel? Because if they are concerned about the well-being of beaches and parks, you would think that they would all be against this motion as well. Do you have any idea where they stand?
So remember, this has only just started. But we have started to reach out to those neighborhood councils. And what I recognize when I was making calls to the council offices, the straight-up council offices, was this concern when I said, you realize your constituents are not going to be safe to go to the beach anymore. Their families aren't going to be able to come out and be and enjoy our parks any longer.
And some of the parking lots will be filled up. There won't be enough space to park.
There won't be space to park. It won't be safe, and there won't be space to park. I felt this like really strong sense of, oh, wait a minute, this is affecting us too now.
Yeah.
This isn't just their problem. This isn't just their councilman who's got crazy ideas. This is now affecting all of Los Angeles, because that is a part of town that has always been there, that has been safe for everybody to go to.
Clean,
safe, accessible. And we've worked hard to – the Pacific Palisades has historically worked really hard to protect beaches and parks. It's written in all the laws for the beach, and it was done intentionally, so that the city of Los Angeles as a whole could enjoy these beaches and parks. This is not a Pacific Palisades issue. This is a Los Angeles issue.
That's what I would like to see.
Just to clarify, so Steve asked if you were reaching out to other neighborhood councils. And then when you were talking about calling other council offices, you're talking about reaching out to other council members, other districts.
Yes, so we've done that. But we are now joining, we're like dividing up our resources to go to the actual neighborhood councils.
Okay, good. And then, so Pacific Palisades obviously does not have a neighborhood council. We do have a community council. Are you in touch with them also?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, because it seems to me that...
Well, Steve's on the board.
I'm on the community council, yeah. It seems to me that if this is painted as an issue of rich people in the Palisades don't want homeless people there, That's not a good look. But if you have people from neighborhood councils all over Los Angeles City saying, we don't want our beaches to be ruined because that's where we want to take our kids. If we're driving from San Fernando or from wherever it may be, we want to have a clean beach. It's impacting them in a negative way too, not just the people who live in the Palisades. And I think that's important.
I'd like to just say that this whole idea of the Palisades rich people not wanting homeless around, it just needs to end. I think we need to end that conversation. It's not helpful. It's a silly made up story for others to think that they're sounding good or to try to influence something. It just doesn't work. You know, human beings in general are compassionate. They care. As a social worker working in a synagogue for a decade, I was connected to all the other churches and other, you know, religious institutions in our community. People behind the scenes are constantly helping others who are struggling. And it doesn't matter if you're in a wealthy neighborhood or if you're in a poor neighborhood. Human beings are human beings, and we all have the same natural instincts, regardless of the money that's in our bank accounts. And what we're talking about here is natural human instincts for caring for other humans. And we need to take out of the conversation that for some reason the whatever's in your bank account or whatever your house looks like or wherever you live has anything to do with your ability to care. And what I will argue, though, is that when you actually happen to be somebody who's extremely caring, but you have, in addition to that, resources, you can make some real change. In the Pacific Palisades, because of the fact that we have so many resources, financial resources, people who have a lot of resources, we have members in our community who represent the biggest institutions, that private institutions that help people who deal with issues of being unhoused or substance abuse or mental illness. So, you know, we need to stop the story of if you're wealthy, you don't care, because it's not anywhere near true. Not only do you care just as much as everybody else, but you oftentimes have the resources to be able to make a difference. So
I mean, it would be interesting to take a look at Palisades and figure out how the Palisades can be helpful versus, like, you know, as you were saying earlier, to like equate every part of town and say, well, everybody's got this district and this is what you have to do in your district and here's your quota, go to it. You know, maybe you could look at neighborhoods uniquely and figure out what resources people, you know, different neighborhoods can sort of lend to the broader problem and holistically look at, you know, what we can all put into the pot to create opportunities for people who are homeless. And again, not all homeless people are created equal. Some people need housing, some people need opportunity, some people need a job, some people need vocational skills. I mean, some people need to be connected with their families again, some people need, you know, substance abuse help. Homelessness comes in all different shapes and sizes. So I tend to agree with you. I think if you look at what communities, what resources communities have to offer, you might be able to find better, more creative solutions. I was going to ask you if you've heard of a film called The Advocates. And if you haven't, I'm going to send you a link. It actually came out a couple of years ago. I was one of the people they interviewed at the time because I was the chair of the Task Force on Homelessness. And in fact, the film mentions sort of our community-centric ability to look at homelessness, different time, different resources. I don't want to equate, you know, what we were doing at the time, because we weren't looking at housing. We were just saying, well, what can we do? The Advocates talks about all of the resources that have been taken away from society, right? So mental health resources, right? Substance abuse resources that have been sort of sucked out of the general societal safety net, and how as a result, people have kind of fallen onto the street. And we've watched that for decades. And now suddenly we're like, well, wait a minute, why are there so many people on the street? And the answer probably is that we've, you know, pulled away a lot of resources. And now I think government is trying to figure out how to corral those resources back. And they're looking at private communities, private institutions, and that's a slow process.
No, this is an emergency. That's one thing that I will agree when the city says we have an emergency. This isn't just a city issue. This isn't a state issue. This is a national issue. This is how we treat our members of our community and what we value and what we're paying attention to. And that is something that we need to look at in terms of our culture. Yeah. And I think we need to be willing to look outside of our country for some of the solutions that they have elsewhere. There's a lot of countries who fare much better than we do.
So I can plug now, I believe. At some point towards the end of July, I'll actually be leading a conversation for the LA World Affairs Council on homelessness. And we're going to try to look at other cities and see what they do. And I would love to have you involved in that conversation because you obviously have the ability to look at other cities. So I think this has been an incredibly enlightening conversation.
You know, as I was saying in the beginning, we just met in person not long ago. And I didn't know a lot of the things you told us today about your background. But as I'm sitting here thinking, you know, I see where you had been in business. You learned how to deal with people, learned how to solve problems, and then you become a social worker and you're solving individual problems. And now it seems like you've kind of put that all together and you're dealing with trying to solve a bigger problem. And, you know, as Miriam was saying, oh, you took over as president last year. No, it's been about 3 months. And you went from being a, an unassuming Palisades resident to a rising star who just took to the media. I know you didn't have any experience of that, but you've done an amazing job and you have focused the community on this issue. And you've done an amazing job, and it'll be interesting to see where this goes and where you go from here.
Thanks, Steve. It's been a lot of fun. I believe that, you know, you have to put your heart, you don't have to, but for me in my life, I don't have any other choice. I put my heart in everything that I do. I make sure I come from a place of love. I come from a place of deep caring and compassion, and I have no other purpose in life other than to just show up every day and do my best to bring just a little bit more light and a little bit more love to this world. That's it. That's all I live for.
Well, you've done an amazing job so far, and I look forward to working with you in the future and seeing where this whole thing goes.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me today.
It has been a pleasure to have you here today. I'm so glad we were able to catch up with you and have you in the studio to chat for about an hour. It was an excellent conversation, and thank you for everything that you do.
Jessica Rogers, thanks for being our guest, and we'll look forward to seeing you around the community.